Today's podcast is brought to you by the Herzog Foundation. On today's program, while we were at CPAC recently, Kimberly Fletcher caught up with her good friend, Mike Rowe. You know Mike, he's a producer, the host of the long-running TV series, Dirty Jobs. Well, let me tell you, Mike sure spilled the tea about his mom and especially what his mom said to him that was the genesis behind the start of Dirty Jobs. You don't want to miss this one. Stay with us. This is the Moms for America podcast. Each week, leaders and everyday champions tell personal stories, share advice, and tackle the issues most important to moms. Hi, moms. I'm Debbie Corlettis, your host, and welcome to the Moms for America podcast. So glad to have you joining us again this week. Every episode, we get together to inspire, encourage, and educate moms in their journey through motherhood. So again, just delighted to have you this week. While today's program, boy, this is really a great interview coming up. I'm sure that most of you are very familiar with Mike Rowe and his extremely famous TV show called Dirty Jobs, which highlighted those who worked in the skilled trades. Now, Dirty Jobs exploded onto the Discovery Channel and was on for more than 20 years. Dirty Jobs made Mike Rowe a household name, and he can add Emmy Award-winning TV host, he can add producer, narrator, podcaster, spokesman, best-selling author, and recording artist to the list of his many accomplishments. Mike has become America's leading advocate for skilled trades, and he launched a foundation called MikeRowWorks.org to promote the important value of the trades and elevate those who work in them. But if it hadn't been for Mike's mom, Dirty Jobs may have never have happened.
The first time that I found out about Dirty Jobs and I was looking at what you were doing, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what we need. They're pushing our kids to college. Look at all these great opportunities they're missing. So I started following you and trying to push this entrepreneurial idea on my kids. And then you wrote this letter about your mom. And I said, I love this guy.
Well, the letter, actually, it was from my mom to me. You're talking about her big blue purse?
Yes, yes.
All right, so the short version, if you're not up to speed, is my mom got upset with me because she called me two or three times and I couldn't get back to her because I was in a septic tank somewhere filming the show. She's like, Michael, I have to talk to you. Michael, I have a story. Michael, I have to talk to you. And by the time I got the third message, they were all stacked up and she, in her frustration, had sent me an email instead. And in the email, it's basically a 1,200-word story about how she lost her blue purse at the local Walmart and how my dad went on this odyssey to find it. It involves like dumpster diving and hearing aids and mistaken identities. And I'm sitting at my kitchen table reading this thing and laughing only the way a son can laugh, right? At his mother. I'm like, this is great. Now, my mom, by the way, has been writing every day for 60 years. She's a born writer. She'd never been published or anything. But this story was so funny, and I was running to catch another flight. So I set my iPhone up against a bottle of wine on my table, and I hit record, and I read this story, right? And then I posted it on Facebook, and I went away for a week. When I came home, that video had been viewed 70 million times. By a lot of moms and a lot of publishers,
yeah,
who were like, hey, maybe this Peggy Rowe person, maybe, you know, she could stitch together a few more stories like this and she'd have a book. And so I called one of the publishers and I said, are you serious about it? And she said, yeah, we just need you to be in the stories because we need an angle, right? And we need to stitch the stories together.
She is in.
So my mother says, huh. So you're in all the stories then? I said, well, that's what the publisher wants. And my mother says, well, you know, Michael, I have two other sons. I'm like, Mom, just do what they say and you'll have a book. Remember, all my mom has ever wanted is to be a published author. She writes every day for 60 years, nothing.
Right.
She's 80 years old. I read this story. She winds up writing a book. I'm not in it at all. It's called About My Mother. It's about my grandmother.
Oh.
gets published anyway, goes to number 4 on the New York Times list.
And you're not anywhere in
I'm
it.
I'm not in it. So that was 7 years ago. My mom has since written 3 more bestsellers.
That's awesome.
Anyway, that's who my mom is. I got it out of my system. She's out of control. She drives around now. She's got her books in her trunk, and she signs them for people.
I love that.
And she's living her best life.
I love that. We got to interview your mom. I think that having a son that recognizes the value of the mom when you are in a position where everybody thinks, gosh, it's my crow, and you're like, yeah, but my mom. I just think that's pretty awesome.
Well, it's especially poignant for me because the Dirty Jobs was a big deal, and it led to a lot of other things that did well, including a foundation, which is why I'm here now. And in the course of talking about those things, you know, I award work ethic scholarships through my foundation. I talk about work ethic every day, and I use my granddad as an example. He's the guy that Dirty Jobs was dedicated to. And I use all the people that I've worked with over the years to demonstrate the kind of work ethic that my scholarship fund tries to encourage. But all this time, Kim, right in front of me, is my mom, who gets up every day, for as long as I've known her, and writes, like, unauthorized biographies of the people she meets. This is how I grew up. My mom would, like, see a cop on a horse, and she was horse crazy, right? So she'd go up to the cop and interview him. She had her yellow legal pad, and she'd just get a whole example of his day. Right? And then she'd, you know, try and interview the horse, and it would be funny, and she'd have all this story, and she'd go home and she'd write it, and she'd put it on the refrigerator, and my dad would take the story down the next day and read it to the kids, and then he'd take it to church, and he'd read it to the church, and then he'd take it on the elevator, and God help you if you're on the elevator, because he'd be like, hey, have you heard the latest from Peggy Rowe? And he'd read it to her there. He would read it at the Bob's Big Boy to anybody. Like, so I grew up with my dad reading my mother's stories.
He's a reporter.
He's a town crier, and she is like an embedded reporter wherever she goes.
Fantastic.
Well, you can't
no
make it up.
It's no wonder that you turned out so amazing because you have such an incredible mom.
Stop.
Tell me, how did this whole Dirty Jobs thing start? I never heard that story.
Okay. Well, given the podcast I'm on, I'll tell you the truth. And I normally don't, I don't really take it to this level, but it started because of my mother. So I was working for CBS in 2001. I was hosting a show called Evening Magazine. It was came on after the local news. It was okay. It was a cushy job, but I would go to I'd go to wineries and I'd go to restaurants and I'd go to museums, and from these locations I'd throw to these pre-produced stories. That's what I did as a host, right? One day my mother calls me and says, "Michael, your grandfather just turned 90 years old, and I have an idea." Now, my granddad, just so you know, this is my mother's father, was a magician, not by trade. He was a tradesman, but I saw him as a magician. He could take one of these cameras apart and put it back together blindfolded.
Wow.
He could overhaul an engine. He could fix a combine. He could build a house without a blueprint.
You know, people even do that anymore?
No. And he only went to the 7th grade.
Wow.
Right? So he wasn't educated in a traditional sense, but he had that chip, and he could build or fix or fabricate really anything. And I was just so enamored of following in his footsteps, and I learned very young. I was 15 or 16 when I realized the handy gene is recessive. I didn't get it.
Right?
But
does it skip a generation?
I think it does, you know. And it was a big lesson, you know. Just because you love something doesn't mean you can't stink at it. And that I learned that early, and my pop told me to get a different toolbox and encouraged me to get into the business I'm in today. All that's just kind of a parenthetical, because my mom knew how I felt about my granddad, And my mom knew that my granddad had spent the last 20 years, I was 42 at the time, watching me sing in the opera and sell stuff on the QVC cable shopping channel and do all these commercials and stuff that didn't make any sense to his brain. But he's proud of me, right? So my mom calls and she says, Michael, your grandfather turned 90 years old yesterday, and I was thinking, before he dies, wouldn't it be terrific if he could turn on his television and see you doing something that looked like work?
Like, God, Mom.
So, of course she's right, you know? I'm like, why can't Evening Magazine be hosted from a construction site or a factory floor or real, you know, a lumberjack camp? This is me telling my boss I wanna take the show in a different direction. I said, why can't it be hosted from a sewer? And he said, you wanna host Evening Magazine from a sewer? I said, why not? He goes, yeah, you know what? Nobody's watching the stupid show. Do whatever you want. So I took my camera guy the next day into the sewers of San Francisco. What happened down there is the subject of a book I wrote a few years ago because it changed everything I thought I knew about making television. It transformed me, really, from a host into a guest. Because when I was in the sewers, I wound up working with a sewer inspector. And in the course of our work, the viewer got to see something they had never seen before.
Yeah.
Right? Aside from a very unusual setting, they got to hear a totally anonymous man who had never been on TV before talk credibly about his work. And they got to see me, a host, or a guy who has been impersonating one, try to keep up as an apprentice, mixing the mortar and hammering out the rotten bricks and squatting there in that river of filth with the rats and the cockroaches. And it was so disgusting, but so honest. And when I got back to the station and looked at the footage, I realized that it wasn't like anything I'd seen on TV before. Mm-hmm. So I put it on, and that segment eventually turned into Dirty Jobs.
You know what's funny? Is because I watched Dirty Jobs for so long, I just assumed you were a construction worker before that.
Everybody does.
Like, you're just so, I don't know, you're like a champion for all the people who are doing this work. And jobs, some of them, I'm trying to remember the one that I watched, and I'm just sitting there fascinated because I was like, you know, I guess that's a job, but I hadn't really thought about that. And it's you're bringing light to all kinds of opportunities that are out there that people don't even know. We had John Ratzenberger come to an event. You know him.
I know John.
He was a roofer before he was an actor.
He was, and he had a great foundation. I don't know if he still does, like Nuts and Bolts and Thingamabobs.
I think he still does.
Like,
I think he still has that.
Yeah.
But so he came out and he spoke at an event, and he asked a question, and he said, "What do you think is the average age of the producer in America?" And this was, now understand, about 10 years ago, okay? And I'm thinking, I don't know, 35, so you know, people are 35, 25, 40, and he said 60. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? What?
Yeah.
As I've looked at the Dirty Jobs episodes, I've noticed that a lot of these people are 50, 60, 70 years old. And I thought, this is an opportunity for us to show these kids that there's another way to go.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to go to college. And one of the things that John said was, he told his son, when his son was going to go to college, he said, you can do that anytime. He said, go get a skill that they can't take away from you, and then you can go to college for business. So he went, and I can't remember what skill he took, but it was something in construction. And then he went and got his business degree, and then he started a construction company, makes a bunch of money.
Yeah.
Because he knows the job.
Yeah.
And it's not just somebody who's deciding they're going to start a business. It's somebody that did the work in the business, and it's why he became so successful.
There's such a power to finishing a thing.
Yeah.
And Dirty Jobs and Dirty Jobbers, by and large, deal in a world where there's a beginning and a middle and an end. And so, by and large, they don't need the kind of, they get the feedback every minute from the work. They don't need a supervisor telling them how they're doing, right? You're building a bridge, you know how you're doing. You're digging a ditch, you know how you're doing, right? The work is the proof of how you're doing. And I took that for granted when I was a kid, and I didn't really understand it until I got into Dirty Jobs. But to your point, by the second season, I realized the show really wasn't about dirt or jobs. It was about the people.
That's right.
It's about the people who did the work and the enthusiasm for the work that they brought, you know, and the dignity that was inherent in so much of what they did. All that stuff came out of watching the work and doing the work. Dirty Jobs was never scripted. It was never cast. We never hired an actor or a writer.
You just showed up on the job?
We never did a second take.
No, really?
Yeah. I didn't want a performance. I didn't want anybody to feel like they had to perform. I didn't want anybody to feel like they could do anything wrong, except me. Like, it's like I'm the apprentice, so if there's a joke, it's on me, right? The real stars of that show were the people we featured and eventually my own crew. You know, the thing I will take credit for that was really important to me early on was getting a behind-the-scenes camera.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of it like a documentary camera.
Right.
Like, if you had one now, I think you do, like filming wide, like showing these guys here, showing...
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's like, it's... That never used to happen in TV. But when you show the viewer the reality of making the thing, then you bring them into your camp, and they get to go along for the ride. So our behind-the-scenes camera wound up capturing a level of verisimilitude, they'd call it, or just truth, that you didn't see in other reality shows. And that gave me a great deal of trust with the viewer and credibility. And, you know, we never got anything perfect, but we did everything honest. And so over the years, job after job after job, it began to form a kind of mosaic, like a quilt, you know? So like I had permission to go to the La Brea tar pits one day, and the next day I'm making blueberry pies with grandmothers somewhere up in Maine. And then the next day I'm cleaning skulls in Oklahoma and then diving for golf balls in alligator-infested swamps.
That one was a crazy one. That was crazy.
But the beauty of it, Kim, was that no 2 days were the same.
Right.
And
you don't have to wear a suit anymore.
Well, rubber suits. I wore a lot of plastic suits. I wore a lot of rubber suits. But it's true, even at a place like this, like I'm at a...
If you came in a suit, they'd be like, who is that?
I know. I'm at a black tie event tonight.
Is that how you're coming? I love it.
I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I truly don't.
No, this is who you are.
This is who I am.
All right, after the break, Mike Rowe talks about millions of good-paying available jobs in the U.S. and the lack of workers. Stay with us. We're going to be right back. Hi, moms. I'm excited to share some news about our new sponsor, the Herzog Foundation. We know you're passionate about raising patriots and empowering your children with the best education possible. And the Herzog Foundation shares that passion. They're dedicated to promoting liberty through education freedom and helping parents like you choose the best educational path. They offer a powerhouse of resources designed to support families and schools alike. Whether you're ready to dive in headfirst to the world of education or simply looking for more ways to empower your child's learning. From free training events to their must-read online publication, The Lion, they're committed to keeping you informed about what's happening in education. Also, if you've ever thought, moms, about starting your own Christian school or co-op, their School Box online course will give you everything you need to get started on the right foot. Again, we are so proud to partner with the Herzog Foundation, and we encourage you to explore all their amazing tools and the insights that they offer. So go ahead, visit herzogfoundation.com to learn more. You won't want to miss these incredible resources. Again, find it all out at herzogfoundation.com. All right, welcome back, moms. Before we continue with our interview, I would like to invite all of you to like, subscribe, and share our podcast. Share this with your moms. This is such a great podcast. I mean, what Mike and Kimberly are talking about is foundational to America, America Jobs. So I know moms would love to hear this because we've got to get back with the trades. All right. So moms, please like, subscribe, and share this podcast with your friends. Also, if you have an idea or a topic for our podcast, would you please email me at podcast@momsforamerica.net. I would love to hear from you and get your suggestions. Lastly, I do want to invite all of our moms that are listening to please join the movement here at Moms for America. If you are not a part of our sisterhood, our movement, please join us. We are here. I say this all across the country. We're the ultimate support group. It's moms like us uniting all across the country, and we're fighting for faith, family, freedom, and the Constitution. So please check us out at momsforamerica.us. Join the movement and take advantage of all the incredible support that we have for you moms. All right. Well, now let's return to Kimberly Fletcher's CPAC interview with Dirty Jobs host and producer Mike Rowe. Mike, you can tell, is very passionate about the skilled trades. And in this part two, him and Kimberly talk about the trades and how detrimental it has been to our job force that many schools have removed shop class from their curriculum.
There's something amazing that happened from the show. Not only did you inspire a lot of people, not only did you highlight work ethic and see real people, you sparked a whole new line of television programs.
Look, I don't want the credit and I don't want the blame for swamp people or ice road truckers. It was the beginning of a shift. I think maybe the way I think about 2002, there was no reality TV. There was no Kardashians.
No.
There was no...
Thank goodness.
Whatever. To each his own.
Right.
The only reality shows that were on the air were Survivor.
Right.
And Jesse James was building motorcycles in Monster Garage.
I remember that one.
Monster Garage was... But that was it. And so most of what Discovery was all about in those days were David Attenborough and Jacques Cousteau and Jane Goodall.
Yeah. I mean, that's okay. But...
Well, they were experts and they were authority figures and they were on camera all the time.
Yeah.
Talking like this and saying very important things about the nature of things, you know, and that's how nonfiction TV was.
You made it real.
Well, I thought, because I'm not an expert in anything, the only thing I could really offer was a level of authenticity. And I didn't know if people would buy it or not, but I was very honest on Dirty Jobs. I was very honest because we never did a second take, and I was honest because if I didn't know how to do something, I wouldn't pretend I did. In fact, if you think of it like managing expectations, every day I showed up to say, "Hi, I'm Mike, and this is Kim, and she's got a show, and she's in charge, and now you know what I know."
So you didn't even do any back work, any backstory? No. This is incredible. And honestly, it's kind of, I don't want to say easy TV, but it's simple TV, where you go in, you film, you don't have to take multiple takes, you don't have to have scripts, you don't have to have this major production crew, and then you just go on the edit floor.
It's in life. And my mother, if she were here, I know she would agree, but all things are a trade. Everything is a bargain. You can, if I were a mathematician, I would talk about every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Right.
The same is true emotionally, I believe. The same is true in all things. But what was the trade? Okay, Mike, you don't have to do any homework. You don't have to do any research. You don't even have to be competent.
You just have to put on a rubber suit, a plastic suit, and walk in on the TV set.
What you have to do, on the other hand, is you have to be willing to take a pie in the face. You have to be willing to show the viewer the depth of your incompetence. You have to be willing to not only fail, but to fail every single day.
And publicly.
And publicly, and with good humor, right? You have to be willing to do all of those things. And I'd make that trade again, but honestly, in the early days, it was, if I'm really being honest, it was very, it was very humbling.
I was just gonna say that word.
It's humbling.
Has to be.
Because I have an ego, right? I mean, I think it's healthy. I hope it's not out of control, but it might have been a little out of control in 2001. It might have been why my mom called to say, hey, maybe you do something that looks like work.
Like you're working.
Because what I'd been doing before then was finding my mark and hitting my lines, right? If you're a host,
you have a teleprompter.
Or you've memorized it. Or like me, like I would go to a battlefield, maybe I was hosting a show for the History Channel, and I called it the plaque approach, because I would find a statue with a plaque on it, and I'd read everything on the plaque and memorize it. And then I'd turn to the camera and tell you about Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson, as if I'm just walking around like with that knowledge. But I was just full of crap. I didn't know. I was just trying to create the illusion of competence and knowledge in short bursts.
Well, you obviously did well because they paid you for a long time.
They did, but I mean, I did okay. I was actually pretty comfortable for 15 years. When I took my pop's advice, I got a different toolbox. That's what he said. He said, you can be a tradesman, just get a different toolbox. So I did all these, I probably had 300 jobs before Dirty Jobs. And I got pretty facile at impersonating a host. And I got hired a lot. Like my audition rate was very good. If I auditioned for 10 jobs, I get hired for 3, which is real good in my line of work. Dirty Jobs changed everything. In a way, it ruined everything because I was taking my retirement in like early installments. I was working when I felt like it. The problem was, before my mom called me that day, I had a comfortable life that I liked, but I wasn't working on anything that mattered
value
to me.
So once you started Dirty Jobs, did you find yourself, obviously at the beginning it was a struggle, but did you find it to be more fulfilling and like you'd hit your niche, you met your calling and felt like you were making a difference?
I knew at the end of the first season, well, I knew at the pilot episode that we were doing something different. And I knew halfway through the first season, given the amount of letters I got from people who were basically programming the show, hey, Mike, if you thought that was dirty, wait till you see what my mom does, my brother, my cousin, my uncle, right? The viewers were programming the show, and I knew that was special. But it wasn't until the end of that season, I was doing an appearance at a, I think it was a Lowe's down in Woodstock, Georgia. And it was just one of those meet and greets. I think I had made a deal with like Whirlpool or somebody, and I'm doing some commercials, and then, oh, the Dirty Jobs guy is out, and word got around. Well, hundreds of people came out and stood in line. I'm signing headshots out in front of Lowe's, you know? And I'm supposed to be there for an hour, and 2 hours in, the line is just even longer, and I don't know how to get out of there. And then I run out of headshots, and the line is still there. So the people, they go in the Lowe's, and they bought all the plungers and all the toilet seats. And I was autographing toilet seats.
And plungers.
And then this family came up, and there was a kid about 8 years old, and his dad and his granddad, who had flown fighter planes in Korea. And the kid is dressed like me. He's dressed up like Halloween for Dirty Jobs, you know. And they told me they watched as a family, and you know, the old man was emotional because he was a mason and we had just done a show on bricklayers, and it meant the world to him to see his boy watching a show on TV that elevated his trade. And it meant the world to the old man who risked his life fighting a war so his grandkid could have the life they had. And I'm sitting there signing a toilet seat with tears streaming down my face. because my mother called me a year ago to tell me to do something that looked like work.
That kind of looks like work.
Yeah. So, you know, I that's when I thought it's not just a show. And that's when I decided I'll ride the horse as long as it runs. I didn't know it was going to run for 350 jobs.
You know, it was a cultural shift, cultural movement, and to be able to highlight the people who are doing those trades, to even know that those jobs exist. Who does those things? You know, that you, some things you just, like, you take your trash out, or, you know, you call somebody to fix something and you don't think about it.
Yeah.
But when you look at what the skills that they acquire and the things that they do to be able to get those trades, one of the things that I would love, I don't know how we do it, but this idea that there every high school in the country has at least one counselor whose sole responsibility, sole job, is to get as many kids to college as possible.
That's it.
And there's a stigma attached to, like, when they graduate, whatever club they're in, if they're in band or show choir, whatever, they line them all up and say, well, this is the college they're going to, this is the college they're going to. And if they haven't, if they're not going to college, or they haven't given them, because they say, they haven't picked a college yet. But nobody is doing anything else. And I want there to be some kind of movement where the kids, they don't have to say, I'm not wasting my time and money. They could just say, well, actually, I'm going to be making $50,000 this first year because I'm going to go do this. And just make the skill trades exciting again to these kids and help them realize you can be debt-free almost immediately. You can get the trade. There's the other side of that where you have all the people who run the unions, and if you want to be a tradesman, that they're making these laws, like in Nebraska, they recently passed a law, you cannot apprentice until you're 18 unless you're a family member. That needs to stop.
Yep.
And giving these kids opportunities to get their hands in something and do what John said and develop a skill, and then if you want to go to college, fine, but develop a skill.
Yeah, I think that I'm glad you're giving John credit where it's due, because he was early in this. He and I kind of came to this in different ways, but around the same time. And he actually inspired me to talk more seriously about. I started MicroWorks in 2008 on Labor Day, and by 2009 I was taking a page out of his playbook and saying, look, I really think, in the history of education, the most harebrained decision I've ever seen was taking shop class out of high school.
Yeah.
It not only did a huge disservice to local industry and kids who would be well served working in those industries, it removed from view all optical proof of the existence of these trades,
right,
to your point. So if you're just a regular kid walking down the hall from math to English class, and you walk past a wood shop or a metal shop, you know, you can stick your head in and you'd be like, oh,
that looks fun.
That looks like work.
Exactly.
What's going on? What are they making, right? Like,
I took shop. I took shop for 3 years in high school, and they wouldn't let me take it the fourth year. I don't remember why, but something about credits. And I was like, I loved it. I felt like I was doing something with my hands. Every time I completed, it might not always looked great, might not always been straight, and I never, that centimeter thing, I don't know why they tried to push that on America.
We're going metric. No, we're not.
No, we're not. I loved that.
No, we're not.
But I loved feeling like I was, had my hands in something. And like you said, while you're doing it, it feels like you're accomplishing something. And then when it's done, you go, I did that.
There are a lot of ways to wake your brain up. Some people, when they hear poetry for the first time, or a song for the first time, or maybe they see paint on canvas for the first time, they get it. But lots of other people need to see the wood go into
exactly
the mill.
Right.
They need to see the metal fabricated. They need to have their hands on it. It's tactile and it's really important. And a giant part of our workforce, it relies on those people. And those people become skilled and trained precisely because when they were young, they saw a thing or touched a thing that lit their brain up, right? So when we took all the shop class out of the high school, we put something in motion. And part of the reason I'm here at this event today and talking to you is because I can, it's not a straight line, but I can draw a line from taking shop class out of high school to $1.7 trillion in student debt currently on the books, most of which is held by people going after a four-year degree. Only half of whom who finished, by the way.
Right, and so, even when you get out, you can't get a job.
And you still got the debt.
That's right. And so, it's mounting.
It's mounting every day, and the interest is accruing every day. Meanwhile, 7.6 million open jobs exist, most of which don't require a four-year degree, and we can't fill.
I know. So there was a guy who put a big ad in the Pittsburgh, I think it was the Pittsburgh Gazette, huge ad, full page ad. I think it was actually a two-page spread. And it was all about trying to get the iron workers, the welders. The welders, are just you can't get them.
Yeah.
And they're trying so hard. So the answer has been, well, let's bring people from other countries who will do the job. I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. Let's give our children opportunities to apprentice early to be able to understand that these things are out there. I'm going to tell you the saddest story ever. Technical High School was in the started in 1920s in Omaha, Nebraska. It was the first technical school, and technical was, it was the skilled trades. That's
sure.
what it was. And Technical High School was like, it was the brainchild, and everybody started to model it. So you started to have these technical high schools showing up all over the country. In the 1980s, they shut Technical High School down, turned the big, huge building into an Omaha Public Schools monstrosity, and now they're like, we need to figure out how to bring skilled trades back to Omaha. And I'm like, maybe you should have not shut down the thing that was really working. And this brought in bricklayers, this brought in welders, and you didn't have so many of the poor community because they were given opportunities right out of high school. They were given opportunities in high school.
You know, tell me how you really feel, Kim.
I know.
No, look, here's what I think happened, at least the way I remember it, was when I was in high school, the country realized that we actually needed more people in the university system. There was a push for college. And to be fair, we did need more engineers, we needed more doctors, we needed, those vocations are awfully important to our workforce. And there were real slippages happening in them. But what happened was the PR for college did what PR always does. It overreached.
Yeah.
And so we weren't content to simply say, hey, give this institution a second look. What we had to say was, if you don't get a four-year degree, you're going to get stuck turning a wrench in some godforsaken pit of despair. We turned...
Stigma.
That's it. We turned the vocational trades into a consolation prize, mm-hmm. into an educational consolation
right.
prize. And we started promoting one form of education as the best path for the most people. So when people say to me today, Mike, how did college get so expensive so fast? And it did. I mean, nothing in the history of Western civilization has increased more. My four-year degree in 1984 cost $12,200. Today, same school, same course load, 92 grand. That's faster than energy, that's faster than healthcare, that's faster than real estate, it's faster than food. Nothing has ever gotten more expensive more quickly. Why? Because we told a whole generation of kids and their parents that they were screwed if they didn't do it. That's right. And so that's a lot of pressure to put on a kid. So when you look at all of that student debt today and all of these open opportunities at the same time, I just don't think it's a coincidence. Like, the skills gap isn't a mystery. It's just a reflection of what we value. And if we want to close the skills gap, we have to change our own level of gratitude for those muscular trades.
It's really hard.
We have to do it.
I have an idea.
Okay.
A show.
All right.
Get a job. get a job. And we bring kids in, middle school, high school, and we connect them with these people who are doing these jobs, and they just start asking these questions. You get how much money? You didn't have to go to college?
You know why I like you? I'll show you this later just to prove it. About 5 years ago, I put a deck together to pitch a show called Get a Freaking Job. Because I wanted to lean into it a little bit. And I may very well dust it off because...
I think it's needed. I think it could, you know, the culture changes by entertainment, by music, by TV.
By podcasts.
And exactly. And if we had something like that, that we could push our kids to and go, look.
Well, let me tell you why I think maybe now is the time. And forgive me, let me tell you why is about the least persuasive thing. And I'll tell you another thing. No, there's a book, and I think your viewers would appreciate it. Not as much as my mother's books, obviously, but a very good book called Men Without Work. And it was written by a guy named Nick Eberstadt about 10 years ago, and he republished it during the lockdowns. It's a horror story, but it's important to read because it's true. And the stat that sticks with me and worries me today is 7.2 million able-bodied men today in their prime working years are not only unemployed, they're affirmatively...
Is this just in the United States?
Yes.
7.2 million?
7.2 million. This number has never existed in peacetime before.
Yeah.
But right now, 7.2 million men officially not even looking. Now, that's bad, but what's worse is the answer to the question, well, what are they doing? Are they volunteering with the JCs, the Kiwanis Club, the Lions Club, the Boy Scouts, Skills USA, 4-H? Are they involved with their church? 2,000 hours a year, on average, on screens.
Another big issue with moms.
I bet. So, look, all problems are micro and macro.
Right.
Micro works is my foundation. Micro's me. I try and keep it small and granular. So each one of those 7.2 million men, I'd like to talk to them. I'd like to show them.
How do we find
them? I'd like to show them the work. I'd like to say, look, do you understand that there's more to a job than the paycheck? Do you understand?
No, they
what's
don't.
Happening
but
to
this
you.
Is why I think we need to start with, you know, middle school and high school kids and
Absolutely.
Match them with people who are doing this, because I'm telling you, the rising generation that's coming up, they are going to be the ones that are going to save us. But we have to give them something we're saving. We have to give them something to point to, something to believe in. And I don't know, I just, maybe that freaking job thing is...
Hey, I'll leave you with another one, too. This is a great example of how my little MicroWorks mission, I think, has gone macro. I got a call from a company you've never heard of, I bet, called Blue Forge Alliance. All right. Blue Forge Alliance is in charge of something called the Maritime Industrial Base. Maritime Industrial Base consists of 15,000 individual companies, all of whom are tasked with delivering thermonuclear-powered submarines to the U.S. Navy. Three a year, two Virginia-class, one Columbia, right? This is a monumental undertaking. And the cadence of three a year must be maintained for the next decade. Because we're in a new world, Kim. Things go sideways
right.
with Taiwan. It's a hypersonic missile. Our aircraft carriers are vulnerable.
Right.
The tip of the spear are these nuclear-powered subs. So Blue Forge Alliance calls me, and they say, we need to hire some tradespeople, and we were wondering if you and your foundation could help. And I said, well, I'll try. You know, as you've probably learned, it's pretty skinny out there, you know? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, how many do you need? They said, 100,000. Go ahead and spit if you have to. Because I throw up in my mouth a little too. 100,000 tradespeople for one industry that most people don't even think about. They said, we've looked everywhere. We're having a hell of a time. Do you know where they are? And I said, yeah, I do. They're in the eighth grade. They're in the eighth grade right
yep.
now.
I think we got our show.
We have to make these opportunities? That's 100,000 building submarines. There's 80,000 in automotive alone for technicians right now in the automotive industry. 80,000 openings. You start to go down the list and you begin to realize our workforce is wildly out of balance.
Yeah.
And here's the math that keeps me up at night. 5 and 2. For every 5 tradespeople that retire this year, 2 replace them.
Oh my God.
It's been that way for 12 years. 5 out, 2 in. I don't need to be a mathematician.
No, that's not gonna work.
This is bad arithmetic.
Very bad.
So we've got all this like weird downward pressure on the demographics, plus all the stigma, stereotypes, myths, and misperceptions that have to be challenged and debunked. So yes, podcasts and TV and shows like Dirty Jobs and foundations like mine and John's, they'll all play a role, I hope, in turning the ship around.
Kids don't even know they exist.
They don't know.
Moms don't know they exist.
I know. Moms, and they exist. Can I talk to the moms for a minute?
Yes, please.
Moms, look. Sit down with your son or daughter. It's okay. It's okay to want them to go to a 4-year school. There's no shame in that. But look at the money, look at the investment, and then just give the trades an honest look. Go to MicroWorks. We've got all the data there. You can find it anywhere you want to go. Sorry to turn this into a commercial.
Please, I love this.
But not now, I'm talking. I'm telling you, Mom. I'm telling you. It's not about this or that. Show them everything, see what fires up their brain, and then take a lesson from my mom. You know, I say this to my mom all the time when people are like, I say, Mom, you wrote every day for 60 years before you got a book deal. What do you say to people who are struggling and following their dream, but they can't pay their bills because they don't have a skill that's in demand? How do you decide when your encouragement might turn into an enabling thing, right? And she says, Michael, I think of myself like one of those people on the sidelines during a marathon watching the runners, and they're so tired, and I'm just a person with a glass of cool water saying, here you go. And I hope they like it, and I hope it helps them. But I don't know if they're going to finish their race. Like, we none of us know. We don't get to know. All we can do is
plant the seeds.
That's it. We can encourage. And if you want to encourage your kids honestly, I beg you, show them all that's possible. I wanted to be a tradesman so bad. I wept when I realized that my skills didn't line up with my dream. And if I hadn't had a pop with the presence of mind to say, you can be a tradesman, that's just a state of mind. Get a different toolbox. If I hadn't had a mother obnoxious enough to pick up the phone and tell her oldest son to do something that looks like work, I'd still be standing in a battlefield memorizing a plaque, pretending to know stuff I don't really know. So, you know, there's no playbook for any of this stuff.
No, but I love the saying, get a new toolbox. We're going to adopt that one, get a new toolbox, if something isn't fitting. So I just want to leave you with this story, because my son, you met Zach.
Yep.
He never went to college. And he went from one job to another job, and he just asserted himself, and he said, give me a chance. And he ended up being an executive marketing director at a Fortune 500 company and absolutely loved it. But in the interim, during that time, one of the jobs that he got was with a roofing company doing the marketing. When he found out that there was a tornado that went through and the money that came with doing roofing, he said, I'd like to do roofing. So he was selling roofs and putting roofs on and going and talking to neighbors and saying, hey, I can fix your roof. Hey, you guys, let me go see if you need help. He was even going and when they had trees on their roof, he would go and say, hey, let me help you with that. And he'd see them up on a ladder and they're old. And he's like, no, let me go up there and do that. And he'd just be driving by and he'd cut the tree down and wouldn't say anything. He wouldn't pitch him anything. And then they said, you're such a good boy. What do you do? I mean, it was amazing. And now I am so blessed. He was living in Oregon at this company, loved his job, and they started talking about needles and pronouns, and he's like, I'm out of here. And so he went to Branson, started two new businesses. They became self-running, and he said, Mom, I feel called to help you. And I said, I welcome you. Now he's our chief
what
marketing
took you
officer.
So long?
I know. It's just, he's so talented, and he's always been able to provide for himself and his family, and it's just, it's struggle, yes.
But look at what you didn't do. You didn't say, Zach,
you need
your
to go
mother
to
needs you. Zach.
That's right.
I can't do this alone.
I also didn't say you need to go to college, but I'm going to tell you, I came this close.
I bet.
Because I thought, how is he going to be able to provide for his family if he doesn't? But I just don't, thank God for you. You are like a mother's dream, and I don't think you realize what an asset you've been, because we had something that we could show our kids to give them encouragement to realize there are more opportunities than you know. And I'm glad you talked to the moms, because I'm going to tell them about your foundation. I need to get back with John and find out if he is still doing that foundation and let kids know you do have other opportunities.
Well, listen. In the spirit of returning the favor, my mom only gave me everything, you know? And what a privilege to publish her first book for her. I printed 10,000 copies of her first book just because she didn't put me in it, so the publisher didn't take it right away. It wasn't until we sold them in 2 days on Facebook, and then they came.
Then the publisher comes.
Then they come. But to see her having a second act like this, and to be able to fly around with her, and to be able to point to her as not just an example, but like the best example, really, you know, of what can happen if you let your kids find their way, if you stay curious, if you stay patient, and if you do your own work. Can you imagine dreaming of being a writer for 50 years and getting no encouragement, but still writing anyway?
And the joy of it.
So, yeah, if you're game, I'm going to call my mother right now when we're done. I'm going to tell her that we met and that you're a very big deal in the mom world. And if you would have her on, I promise you.
I would love that. We'll go to her.
Done.
Okay.
You'll be going to a retirement community.
That's
great. You'll be meeting my 92-year-old dad. He'll be there too. And Kim, he's going to have questions.
No problem. I have answers.
So many questions.
Yeah. Holy God. Thank you for coming on, Mike. This was amazing.
Thank you. Really fun. Thank you so much.
All right, what a great discussion that Kimberly and Mike had. So, so interesting. And what an incredible testimony to the influence of moms. Mike Rowe's mom in his life was just amazing. And not only was she a mama that trained up her child, but she also really spoke into his career. All right. Well, as Mike said, as moms, we need to encourage our little kids to start thinking about all kinds of vocations. It's not just about college. Trades are so important to America's economy. So talk about it with your kids. Talk about the skilled trades. Actually, you know, maybe have them listen to this podcast with you. So, so interesting. All right. For more information, moms, go to MikeRowWorks.org and check out more from Mike Rowe there. And again, thanks so much to you, Mike. We appreciate it. And Kimberly, you did a great job. All right. As always, thanks so much for being a part of today's program. For more information on Moms for America, all of our amazing programs, our resources, our seminars, our webinars, please go ahead to momsforamerica.us. Join our newsletter. Take advantage of all the support that we have there for you, Mom. Again, we are here to help you in your journey through motherhood. Again, check us out, momsforamerica.us. We say this every week. We have it all for you, moms, from parental rights to public policy, from the kitchen table to Congress. We have it all here at Moms for America. Again, check out our Moms for America past library. Check us out every week here on the podcast. And as always, we will keep changing our country, moms. You got it. One home at a time. See you next week. God bless. A special thank you to our sponsor, the Herzog Foundation. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of the Herzog Foundation.